Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and The Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rothberg. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment, and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report.
Very busy feeding the deer and enjoying the gorgeous weather in Ireland. My best friend right now is cute. He was kissing me. I was kissing him on his nose. It's incredible. Until you've kissed a deer, you've not lived.
I'm glad you're here. So grab a drink. Let's have a conversation about music and sync. Oh,
Paula, come to the stage, unmic, and say hello. Tell us what's going on.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How was your week? How are the kids? How's the family?
Well, you know, another crazy week in our house. Galleries, museums, trip to the seaside.
Actually, watch your feed and see the cultural experience that you're sharing with those kids.
They're getting a lot. They saw a lot of artwork by Tracy Emin this week at the seaside. Free sculptures.
Amazing. Oh, how cool. Yeah. I'm on my toes. I had my coffee tonight. I am so amped for tonight's show. Paula, who do we have tonight? I think somebody extremely special.
Very exciting. I am actually really excited for this fantastic show. We have got Patrick Eccleston on The Sync Report today, joining us to talk about filmmaking, NFTs, and music. Cool. So Patrick is a commercial and fine art photographer and director who's contributed extensively to the best, Vanity Fair magazine. Mm. We've all seen his photos across billboards, magazines, buses, and I've seen them on the London Underground. You may not have done. His images have been used by all the major film studios, DreamWorks, Lionsgate, Warner Brothers, the TV networks such as CBS, CNN, Fox, Lifetime, Showtime, and the list goes on. He has shot portraits of many of my favorite celebrities, including Angelina Jolie, Steven Spielberg, Jamie Foxx, Jason Statham, Nick Jonas, my husband, Robert Downey Jr., Jennifer Aniston, and he's collaborated frequently with my daughter's current favorite singer, which is Demi Lovato.
Ah, she's amazing.
She's amazing. And in fact, he directed Demi Lovato's Stone Cold music video,
which has been massive.
It's been viewed over 200 million times.
Oh my God.
Incredible. There's more. I haven't finished yet.
Come on.
He's also photographed Lovato for her rather famous spontaneous nude makeup-free photo shoot, which was in Vanity Fair.
I saw those photos. Oh my God.
He's amazing.
Amazing. Go ahead.
I was going to say, like, his images are used for advertising shows, you know, Succession, Homeland.
It's incredible. And we have him on such a good night tonight. There's so much we're going to talk about. He's so talented. I mean, have you seen the website? His pictures are just breathtaking.
It's essentially a who's who of Hollywood. I'm not jealous. I'm really not.
So jealous. I want to be his PA. I wonder if he needs to hire an assistant.
I'm there first.
So yeah, like you said, we're going to talk films, we're talking music, we're talking NFTs. All right, with no further ado, I'd love to welcome my new best friend, Patrick, to the stage. Patrick, please unmic yourself and say hello.
Hey, way to tee that up, guys. Thanks so much for the warm introduction and hello, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Can you tell how excited we are to have you?
Yeah, you know, when you guys called, I was like, why do you want me to do this? But, you know, as I talked about it more, I'm like, you know what? I guess maybe I could share some insights.
Oh my God, you have such a story. I mean, I've had the pleasure to have a couple of phone calls leading up to the show with you. And I mean, just absolutely mind blowing. I mean, forget about the list of credits and celebrities you've shot. I mean, some of the stuff we're going to talk about, I think my audience is going to flip out. So To get us started, I mean, you're an LA boy like me. You grew up in LA. What was that like growing up in Los Angeles? Were you in Hollywood proper? Where did you grow up, Patrick?
I was born in Hollywood, just off the Sunset Boulevard. My parents, they got separated early, so I moved around with my mom a lot and lived in Maryland and DC and San Diego and Vancouver and kind of all over the place. But then my parents got back together about 7 years later. And from that point forward, we went back to LA, and then I was a Burbank kid growing up in the Valley. The San Fernando Valley, you have a lot of people who are kind of transitory at, you know, coming into LA to pursue their dreams.
You have to remember Valley Girl, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That story has so much truth to it, as far as what I remember growing up in that area.
Yeah. I think of Earth Girls Are Easy for some reason. That one has such like pop culture references for that time period. When I look back at through the lens of my childhood, what I would want it to be, that's like my 14-year-old self going, wow, that was pretty awesome.
Although there was a lot of Valley guys are fighting with the Hollywood guys. The Hollywood guys are fighting with the Malibu guys. So yeah, it's really kind of made for film, that whole LA lifestyle. But also talking about made for film, I mean, there was a huge cinema golden period of time in LA when you were growing up. I'm sure you must have been frequenting these cinemas and watching these films that were coming, and maybe your early entrance into the visual arts?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my mom was an illustrator, and so she taught me how to compose through drawing line and line work, but I didn't have the patience for that. So I drew a lot of my inspirations from films and television growing up as a kid, as I think anyone probably who grew up in LA does, because you're just saturated with it. Everywhere you go, it's all you see. And then growing up, and you know different people who go to different schools, and somebody's on a Disney show, and another kid who you know from junior high gets some big job playing Mel Gibson's son in a movie, and you're like, oh my God, I know these people. And most of them turn out being juvenile delinquents, which is interesting.
There is that side of it for sure. Oh God.
Oh yeah. Yeah, there's the dark side for sure. But yeah, it's a great place to grow up. I mean, definitely a little weird. I think people like us from LA, as long as we have a chance to get out from it for a while and come back, we're okay. That's true anywhere you live, honestly. Like, you kind of got to go away and come back to really fully appreciate it. Because LA does have a lot to offer, but you have to step away from it.
That's the thing. If you're in the middle growing up in it, you don't appreciate it. Like you, my folks split when I was young, and I went back and forth San Diego to LA. I adored living in San Diego. I have some of my best friends in the world there. But talking about that whole time period growing up in LA, that might bring some lovely memories for him to spark our next conversation.
Only my favorite movie.
What are we listening to here? Tell us about this film. Tell me about how you discovered Run Lola Run. Give me some of the young Patrick influences here.
Run Lola Run. ArcLight Cinemas and independent cinemas, the Lemleys, the Pacific, the Arrow, and a bunch of great independent film houses around LA. This movie popped up after winning the Audience Award at the Cannes Film Festival, might have been Sundance. It won the Audience Award for one of those big festivals. I think it won the Berlin 7 Academy Awards and German Film Festival that year. And it's Tom Twyker, who's a brilliant director. And what he did, which was really cool with this film, is he did all the music working with two other composers. They wrote the score before they shot the movie. And then when they shoot the movie, they play the scenes from the music as they were capturing their visuals on set. And then they would go back to the editing room and they would cut to that music. And then they go, you know what? We want to tweak this a little bit because it's not quite working. And then they go back to the music and rewrite for the edit and then bring it back in. So it's an incredible visual masterpiece, first of all, because they're using all kinds of different film stocks. They're going video. They're using stills. They're using animation. They're breaking all the rules, everything. And they're telling a really compelling story about a woman who's trying to save her boyfriend. And she's got 20 minutes to get 100,000 Dutch marks or else he's going to get killed by the mob. It's high intensity action. It's like an experimental thriller is probably the best way to define it. And at that time period, there had been nothing like it. And I still think there's nothing that really compares to that. I think I've seen the movie at least a dozen times. And for anybody who's never seen Run Lola Run, I highly recommend that you check it out. Get the version that's got the subtitles. You don't want to listen to the dub. You need to check it out with the subtitles and see the original mix the way it was intended to be portrayed. This movie, it floated around in LA for 8 months straight. And it was a foreign film. Like foreign movies pop in, they go, they're gone. This started out one theater. It spread to like 6 theaters, 12 theaters, 15, 20 theaters, and then finally died out. But it stuck around. There wasn't one consecutive week for 8 or 9 months where this movie was not playing in Los Angeles.
How old are you then at this time, Patrick? When did you discover Run Lola Run?
25?
25.
Yeah.
So I got to bring you backwards then. We have to go one more song. And then this is going to actually kick off a little bit of a challenge here. In the 90s, Patrick's a teenager and he gets turned on to a series that many of us grew up on. So he's watching it for the second time in the 90s when, you know, you would assume everything in the 80s was unpalatable. Ooh, turn that up.
Come on in.
It's such a great scene.
Honestly, the amount of people this particular TV show touched, but watching it with you, I understand it completely. I mean, we watched that 3-minute clip together, and the cinematography, the combination of the music, the visuals, even the dialogue, as you were breaking it down to me. Patrick, tell me, that teenage boy, what was your walk away from tuning into this series?
So when the show came out, just to put in a little context, I was a little too young for it. So I got it on first run syndication back when I was in my senior year of high school, and I really got into it. Kind of a nice escape from the valley, being in this vibrant world of Miami with these beautiful people and fast cars and action and drugs and guns. That show is so powerful because it was the first time in contemporary culture where you would watch the show and whatever music they're playing on the show would be a top 40 hit on the radio that just came out at that moment in time. And so you're like, wow, I just heard this on the radio and now I'm seeing it on TV. And look at all these cool clothes. And this is all so contemporary. It was the first time you brought fashion, culture, music all together in one place. And it was electrifying. It was just marvelous. And this scene in particular was the first time they took In the Air Tonight, which obviously is a legendary song, but they incorporated into the pilot episode. And it's just a 3-minute scene with Crockett and Tubbs driving through Miami in a Ferrari at night. And they're loading weapons and getting ready to do battle against the cartel leader. And it's like them against the world. They're totally rogue. They've gone rogue from the police department. They have no support. They're going to do it for personal reasons. And that kind of storytelling just hadn't existed up to that point. That scene is just visuals with music and a little bit of dialogue sprinkled in. When you hear someone singing Phil Collins' powerful vocals like that, and they're incorporating actors' dialogue while the singer's singing, incredible. Like that's a mixing feat in my book. So I listened to that and I watched that scene, and I encourage anybody interested in visuals and cinematography and how that works with music to Google In the Air Tonight, you know.
Oh, I watched the series again now. It's just, you almost don't appreciate or don't remember. Obviously you do, but you know, watching that 3 minutes, I was like, this is some of the best cinematography I've seen on television ever. You know, it was just absolutely incredible, intoxicating. From that conversation, this is a much bigger piece now. I think you actually have some backup on this topic. I have some backup on this topic. My partner, Kevin Sharpley, who is a Miami Vice fanatic, I've invited to be part of this conversation. Kevin, say a quick hello to Patrick.
Hey, Patrick.
Hey.
You're going to bring somebody up to you. Who's your guest that you're bringing up?
Okay, so I got my buddy, Daniel Sackheim, who's in the audience, and I'm going to pull him up.
This man himself and Patrick are just so humble. I'm going to have to say this, but an Emmy Award winning producer, director, one of the most sought after talents working today on television. His credits include True Detective, Game of Thrones, Jack Ryan, Walking Dead, Better Call Saul, The Americans, Lie to Me, House MD, New York. Oh my God, the list goes on. Dan, we are so excited to have you part of this. And also, obviously, some of your credits include Miami Vice. Is that right, Patrick?
Well, okay. So Sorry, Dan, I hate to put you on the spot, but a fun fact about Dan is if you Google search right now, best episodes of Miami Vice, according to fans, the very number one best Miami Vice episode of all time, which comes from season 5, is a show called Mirror Image. And Daniel Sackheim wrote the teleplay.
Thank you, Patrick. I co-wrote the episode.
When has a show theme been a top 40 hit? An instrumental, no less. And it was. It was a top 40 Rick Dees Sunday afternoon. And when you look at the opening sequence, again, look at the visuals and how they sell Miami to just this instrumental, and you'll get it. There's not a more high-octane charged intro in like the history of television, in my opinion.
I mean, this is exactly what this show is about. I'm so glad we've tapped into this, Patrick. I mean, A, like you just pointed out, for an instrumental to chart is unheard of, full stop. But it only gets there when it's driven by a machine like this. The power that television and film has for music, it's just a marriage made in heaven. No record label can give you that kind of promotion that the right placement can. And oh my God, that is such the right placement. So obviously, Dan, that was probably created before you started on Miami Vice. As you were getting involved as music supervision, I mean, I seem to remember a lot of music was being made for the show. Were you actually working with the artists? You were dealing with the labels and publishers? How were you dealing with the music?
You know, in the day, which was, you know, weirdly, everything comes back around again, because back then it was just vinyl. So every day I would get into my office and I would do a day's work. And at the end of my day, I would start sorting through a huge stack of albums and listening to tracks on the albums that were sent by all the labels. And sometimes we found music that way. But usually it was, I was really fortunate to have a number of very talented people around me who were much more hip to music scene than I was, and came in with lots and lots of ideas. The editors were really, really clued into the music scene. So they would come up with a lot of ideas, and some were songs that predated the show, were tracks that had not even been released.
Didn't Glenn do something specific for you guys, and maybe Miami Sound Machine, Gloria Estefan, was that stuff created for the series, or was that already existing?
I know the Glenn Frey song you're referring to, but that was done in a season prior to mine, and I think that may have been one or two. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that what happened was that the show often got some early releases or pre-release songs.
Patrick, you are obsessed with music. You know, your whole system and your Hawaii house is gorgeous. I want to steal that from you. So yeah, how are you hearing the difference between those different sounds of music?
Well, I think there's like more of a Latin world beat that's infiltrated pop music for sure in the past couple of years. And, you know, the synth wave, sort of the retro wave has had a resurgence. Trap has kind of come in and out. That's a new thing, I guess. I mean, there's so many different subgenres now. It's really hard to even classify.
And it's great to they're blending now too, which is lovely.
Yeah, it's really interesting how, yeah, I think as someone who's looking for music scores, there's so many different pools you can tap into now. So many different oeuvres and genres and subgenres. It's kind of hard to classify. So I don't know if that even really answers your question, but there is a lot to tap into out there in the world. And if you're looking for original music, original sounds, the sky's kind of the limit. It's almost hard to find stuff because there's just so much of it.
And it is interesting, Patrick, us obviously that wanted to and did get into music were so influenced by that show. But you know, you as a photographer, I guess the visuals of that production, was that something you found inspiring? Were you shooting in high school? When did you start taking photos?
I did start shooting in high school. And I spent a lot of time in the darkroom and just considered it a hobby until I was in my 20s post-college figuring out my life. And I started shooting headshots of actors and at the restaurant that I was waiting tables, and then started to do so much of that that I was able to quit waiting tables and build a business doing headshots, which then got me onto the set of like ER and West Wing and Without a Trace and Cold Case and CSI and all these Incredible. Other shows. That's how I met Dan Sackheim, actually, because he was producing a show called Life, which I came in. We had to like stage a crime scene in a house, and we started working together. And I was working on a book at that time, and we became friends. And God, that was like 2008, Dan, something like that. It was a long time ago. Yeah. And then we had the shared love of Miami Vice, and which I could continue to talk about.
Yes, no, we're going to circle back.
I got so many more stories about that. But yeah, we're working on a project, which is really cool and exciting. And definitely me and Dan are, which definitely we can get into as well.
Excellent. All right. Well, look, I don't want to stray too far away from Miami Vice. And hopefully, Kevin, I know the reason why I brought Kevin to the stage as well is, A, he's there in Miami, but he also has this really great project that is all based in Miami and very similar in vibe to Miami Vice. So his knowledge, he's studied the show itself. So I had to bring him in. Kevin, tell us a little bit about your love for Miami Vice. Do you have any questions for Daniel or Patrick or any bits of conversation you want to tap into?
Yeah, I can say, and especially living here in Miami, Miami Vice had such an indelible outreach for Miami itself. I know when I would watch Miami Vice as a kid, I would think that Miami was exactly like that. So when I finally moved to Miami, one of the first places that I went to was Ocean Drive, which was that strip where you would see Crockett and Tubbs all the time kind of populating. It's now, you know, multi-million dollar hotels and stuff like that. You know, it really did have this effect on Miami, and you can feel that effect now and on the film and entertainment industry because it was one of the biggest shows of that time. And so everyone that even to this day works in the industry, most of the veteran people worked on that show, Miami Vice. So this is super exciting. For me, Miami Vice was such a huge inspiration because, as Patrick said earlier, there was nothing like it on television. And I would venture to say, even in film, and you can think about it now, that line between film and what is television has blurred so much now. But, you know, Michael Mann, those first two seasons created such an indelible classic impression.
Amazing. The visuals on that are just breathtaking. Patrick, should we play Crockett's theme?
Sure, absolutely. How many protagonists have their own theme song?
It's amazing. Let's cue that one up, yeah? Listening to this.
Okay, so I got a few stories I have to share about the show that I heard ancillary just because this stuff deserves somehow. My dad had a friend named Gary Hughes, who was a VP over at Universal. At the time, the chairman was this guy named Sid Sheinberg, who ran the whole thing, was like an industry giant in television. And so at the time, Miami Vice was the most expensive show on television. It was supposed to be 700,000 an episode, and they're coming in at like $1.2 million, $1.3 million every week. And so they sent Gary Hughes to go to the set and figure out what the hell's going on. So he spent a week in Miami and he spent a couple of days trying to figure out where the money's being spent. And apparently Michael Mann had taken the top floor of this hotel and like not even told people in the hotel what he was doing, but he rented out all the rooms and he brought in a construction crew and demoed walls between it to make it like his lair. And so anyways, when Gary Hughes got done with it, and he went back to go report to his boss, Sid. He said, you know, Sid, the only person who's saving you any money on this show is the wardrobe department. And he said, oh, yeah, how's that? And he said, because every other week when they fly to Italy to get clothes for the boys, they fly coach. They'll fly
first. Oh my God, incredible. So I imagine they got the reins on this, or was it the show was just so successful they just kept on getting away with it?
Dan could probably speak a little more on this than I could, but to my understanding was season two, Michael Mann opted out for whatever reason to go do Crime Story. And then Dick Wolf, who's like the king of Law and Order and procedurals, took over. And so the whole show took a very different dramatic narrative shift. And it went from being like this kind of cool California, Miami, like everything's fast and loose, like this New York, where were you? You know, you were here at this time of day. Oh, it's like became this procedural. And you're like, well, what happened? The whole vibe of the show is something different.
But it's really great to know that backstory.
Yeah, it's still an iconic show. And there's episodes on the seasons one and two that I would put up against anything that's out currently, ranking in some of the best television ever created. It's a lot of it doesn't hold up, actually, in hindsight, but there's still a handful of just marvelous episodes.
Kevin?
Yeah, I would agree with you with those two seasons, but I do think that the first two seasons hold up. I looked at that one where you all played the theme song from the In the Air Tonight. There's a video on YouTube and, you know, it just feels iconic. I would say more than anything, it feels iconic. This whole new wave of nouveau synth pop and, you know, a lot of the throwback to the 80s style of music. It really does play well against that new kind of backdrop. And I have to say, when we were coming up with the project that Jason mentioned, it's called The Beach Chronicles, Miami Beach. You know, we were looking for people that actually were in Miami Vice. So we ended up getting Don Johnson's son, Jesse Johnson, to voice our character as the detective of that particular project. That's how much of a mark that show left.
On yeah. so many people. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's a huge television program.
I had a question for Daniel, actually. Because music was such a driving force of the series and such an indelible part, I mean, it was as important as the visuals, really. Was there a mandate? Was there some sort of rule of thumb that said, hey, this music has to have such a presence in the show that, you know, the choice of the music, the selection of the music became a difficult decision to make?
It had to be cool, and it just had to move you, either emotionally or physically. I think if you didn't go back and listen to it 10 times just because you got excited by it, it's an enthusiasm metric, really, is all I can put on it. I don't ever remember getting a mandate.
Not doing music supervision, but obviously you had your editing experience, which combines both of those platforms. But the pressure you must have felt to find these songs must have been incredible. I mean, do you have any memories of those painful moments and stressing on, do I present an Eagles track versus, you know, whatever you were listening to on vinyl at the moment?
Here's all I can say, and I don't even remember the particular song. I think it may have been Brian Ferry or something. And Michael Mann's thing was, and is to this day, as I understand it, he loved to make decisions in the 11th and 3/4 hour, not even the 11th hour. And I mean, this show was supposed to be on the air like in 3 nights. And he would come to me and say, we have to find something else. Now, clearing music.
How would you deal with that?
For people who don't know anything about it, I'm sure you guys know more about it than I do. But there's not only publishing rights, but there's sync rights, so usually with two different people. You have to negotiate. They're slow moving. And so that's a big task, not just finding the song, but getting the song cleared legally and through all the various parties, and then making a deal that falls within the budget. So I remember being up for about 48 hours trying to make it happen, and then being in an editing session. And that here's, I don't know why I remember this so vividly, but being in an online editing session, because there was no non-linear editing there is today with Avid systems and whatnot, and or the systems people have in their homes even. And I remember being there editing in an online bay because we didn't have time to go back to film. It was film back then, so they had to cut a negative. And so I remember being there, and we're working on it, and there's all kinds of problems. It's in, it's out, and I had two other options, in which then there was a problem. The first one, we dropped the second one in, and you notice people you're working with, and then they're gone, their shift is over, and then they're back. Like they've gone home, and they like had, you know, they've had dinner. Yeah, in different clothes, they've had dinner with their wives, or had sex, or gone to a movie, or done whatever, then slept, and then come back. And I just remember that being as the most surreal experience of my life. But I would say that the big thing was just that Michael, and it wasn't often in the case of music, but he would come in and I should remember what it was, given that it was so disruptive to my life. But I remember those are the kind of things that used to happen, crazy things that you can't imagine.
Honestly, I don't know how you made that happen. That is just a monumental feat in my mind. Here I have the ability for emails and texting. And I mean, I think probably at that time, the best you were doing was sending a fax. I mean, I don't know how you were clearing these licenses with the label and the publisher and still being able to hit your deadlines.
Right. Well, the studio, Universal Studio, obviously, they had a music clearance department, business affairs and lawyers and such. But nonetheless, it's you're on the phone all the time. People forget how much people were on the phone all the time, because there was no texting or email or Snapchat or Facebook or whatever. God, I feel so old now.
Oh,
thanks,
sorry,
Jason.
Daniel, but it happens to me too. It's like, oh, I have to text you before I call. Okay, I didn't realize. Oh, this is incredible. And again, so, for our room here, the Sync Report, this is what we really want to focus on, is that entire process of matching the music to the visual and dealing with last minute changes and contracts. I mean, everyone thinks music supervision is a sexy job. You're doing paperwork 90% of the time. So thank you for sharing that, Daniel.
Hey, Dan, would you speak to, because one of the things that Dan told me a while back that I thought was kind of interesting was he was put in the unenviable position of having to give notes to, I want to say Jan Hammer, but I guess it's Jan Hammer, about how to, I don't even know what notes you had to give him, but apparently he didn't necessarily take too kindly to that at that time. Is there anything you would speak to about that, Dan?
Oh, man. I don't want to get in trouble. By the way, Jason, I think it was, I don't know if you remember this group, Red Rider, but I think it was Red Rider Lunatic Fringe was what we ended up with.
Right.
Anyway, so Jan, yeah. So here's the thing, which is a unique transition that all artists who are songwriters and musicians, and I think of Stuart Copeland, who's a brilliant composer, but he was a member of the Police. And some people make that transition easily and some don't, because film business, as I like to call it, film and television, it's a team sport. You collaborate with a lot of people. And that's one of the things that makes it exciting, and the sort of 1 + 1 + 1 = 10 versus 3. But, when you're a novelist or you're a musician, right, you write for yourself. And you don't have someone editing you or telling you how to change it. And a composer really works at the behest of the producer or the director initially, if it's a feature film. And so Jan had been a recording artist. He had never written for film. Michael discovered him, and a brilliant discovery. And he's brilliant. But, part of the job as a producer is you have to weigh, say, more powerful with what we called scores, right? Which is the blend of source and underscore, which are these songs, right? That became the Miami Vice made famous in tracking scenes with songs. And so on the occasion where something didn't work in my estimation, or I was the mouthpiece for, say, Michael Mann or what have you, then, I would have to relay that information, which I wouldn't say that he enjoyed that part of the process. Let me put it that way. So it's an interesting aspect of filmmaking or storytelling, right? There are people who do their element of it completely by themselves. It's very autonomous. And those that have to do it collaboratively. And I think it was, I remember a few times having the phone hung up in my ear. But that's not to take anything away from him or his talent. It's just something that
part of the natural process. What's amazing in this story is the strength and conviction that you had, somebody that's just starting in the industry, going up to this titan and giving him your notes. I mean, I just can't imagine the inner drama that was going on your approach to passing those notes in.
If I could go back and talk to my younger self, I would probably say, don't freak out as much. It's funny, you have to wrap yourself in this kind of figurative tinfoil, because if you actually think about what you're doing, if you think about the fact that you're making a decision that is going to anger this world famous musician, that is going to have an impact on a show, maybe negatively in terms of, as the viewers see it. And those were the days where shows got 30 shares, right? There were 30 million people watching that show. And that's a thing of the past. Shows don't get more than, I don't know, a couple million, 3 million at the best. The executives at the streamer, they would carry you down a hallway on their shoulders, popping champagne if you got that. But back in those days, if you got I remember when we dropped to like a 30 share. And again, I've been out in the network game for a while, but it's something equivalent to about 30 million households. And I remember everyone being scared we were going to get canceled. I think I can certainly speak for myself that I was very young and I went through a lot of the imposter syndrome, but you have to fake it. You just have to have the courage of your convictions or people will eat you alive.
But you know what I mean? But I mean, are you faking it or are you actually stepping up to you and running to your fear? Probably in the moment, you probably did feel like you were wearing a mask, but obviously you have that eye for detail. You have the patience to make sure everything is perfect, which if you want to be successful, you need to have those skill sets.
I would say that you organically believe in your choice or you do not. And then you are either backed up on it, which I have to say Michael Mann did most times, but you have to have a belief in it. And I can't tell you, even to this day, half the reasons why I don't like an edit or have a problem with a film or a story or the writing in a script that I read. But there's something on a gut level that I think all of us who work as artists, we feel, right? We just know something's wrong. And I think the growth comes in knowing how to articulate, learning how to articulate.
Dan, did you think that, you know, the fact that you weren't really obsessed with music like some of us trying to do that music supervision, do you think immersing yourself in music during that time led to becoming a better director and having these amazing series that you developed and pumped life into? Was there music influence into any of that?
I'm not sure that I can say that there is, other than, you know, I'm with Patrick. Run Lola Run is one of mine as well, all-time favorite films. And the score has a tremendous amount to do with that, right? In terms of helping to sell the level of propulsion. But in terms of the choices I've made artistically, yeah, I'm not sure.
Do you hear songs? Are you playing music in the background as you're storyboarding or scripting, or, you know, or is that a completely separate?
Yeah, for sure I do at times. But I mean, it's usually something crazy like an AC/DC song or something that I think would really drive the scene. I'm not as well versed in dance music per se, or those things that say Patrick is, and we're working on a project which he should talk about because I feel like I'm monopolizing the stage. But we sit together and we run various choices of music to determine what might be the best choice for this NFT, which is very narrative. And I think that the more interesting question is, how do people work together who might have very differing tastes in music? Because it's very subjective.
So I'm glad you actually brought that up. And Patrick, please unmic and join this conversation. This was one of the first things that Patrick shared with me. He was so excited about getting into the NFT world. And I see all these people doing it and they're mixing visual and audio. So I wasn't quite sure what to expect. And literally when I saw the visuals on this thing, it was mind blowing. Patrick, can you tell our audience what it is that you guys have created?
Yeah, we're still sorting it out, but it'll be the first NFT narrative series. We're telling a cinematic story using these incredible images that Dan and I shot for this project called Slow Kiss, which is neo-noir narrative. We got some pretty well-known
actors. Tell us who you shot.
Together. Well, we pulled Adam Arkin and Garrett Dillahunt and Brian T. Like, they're all like big TV actors. Isabella Miko. They've all had series. You recognize their faces. Art LaFleur. And we staged it as if it was a motion picture, but instead of rolling sound and camera doing that, we're like, let's just shoot this as still. So it's high concept, high production value, period clothing.
There's animation, is that right?
Well, we shot it all stills. And then once we were looking at it, we laid it out in a book format as a photography book. And we went, you know what? It's so cinematic the way we shot it. And that's one of the benefits of working with Dan, is we really have brought the best of our two respective disciplines to bear to kind of go full Voltron on this thing and, you know, make it greater than the sum of its parts. And so it's really been pretty
amazing for me to go, okay, we're going to approach the scene. Traditionally, there is a grammar and a language to storytelling. You know, you have your wide or your master, and then you go in for your coverage and you punctuate certain scenes with close-ups and whatnot. But when you're really going for stills and you're trying to make that still image pop, there is like a really powerful thing that happens because you're putting so much energy into every single detail. Because it's not about fancy camera moves to hide things or to get you from here to there. Each image has to be
picture
electric.
Picture literally has to say 1,000 words. You know, really. And you've done it. Looking at those images, I felt the ride going from each location, getting in and out of trouble. And the only thing you guys need to decide on is the music. So how does that argument go between you and Daniel?
That's so funny that you bring that up, because that's exactly kind of where we're at right now with it. Because we have a rough cut of the flow of events for the first drop. We're going to, in success, drop about a dozen different episodes of this as NFTs. So that way people would have to collect all of them if they want to understand the story as a whole in its context as it was meant to be told. Otherwise, you just get a little piece of it. And each piece is incredibly artful and compelling and powerful in its own right. It's like kind of like a puzzle. So people have to, they want to understand the whole narrative, and it's very clear. It's very linear. And they have to collect all the different various NFTs for it. We're at a point right now where we're looking at the music and we're going, what do we put in here? And I have some preferences and that I was leaning into, and Dan sort of was like, well, you know, let's finish the edit first and then we'll get into that. And then I was over at his place the other day and we took a swim in the pool and we're laughing out by the, on the veranda, looking at the San Fernando Valley. And we were playing music for about an hour and a half, just pulling different tracks out and going, you know what, we're kind of, the one thing that is really cool about us is that we have very different approaches, but our aesthetic is very, very similar in terms of the choices that we gravitate towards. So artistically, we put it together like a small playlist of different tracks. And we're like, something like this could probably work as a temp track, but we haven't laid it in yet because we're waiting for the final edit. And there's a couple little transitions and tweaks that we're animating that we're not happy with. Cinematic quality NFT assets.
Absolutely. Walk us through that, because I know a lot of, especially there are songwriters and rights holders in the audience are very interested in NFT and how that works. And I know you had mentioned there's this amazing gallery in New York that the NFTs will be released through, but what exactly are you selling? Is it people will own their own blockchain connected NFT? Is there a high value and everyman value? How are you selling the NFTs?
Well, first of all, there is a prominent gallery that we've been talking to, but that's not solid yet. We're figuring out what the best way to distribute it is, but we'll be marketing it. And that's a part of it, is because you do have to promote the stuff when you put it out there. And I think we have some choices. There's a bit of a reckoning here that has to be made. We haven't figured that part of it out because Dan and I have just been really focused on the creative part of it, which is taking a lot longer than we thought it would. The thing about NFTs, for anybody who doesn't know, I mean, at this point, I'm sure everybody's heard of it and people kind of understand it. Non-fungible tokens. It's a cryptocurrency exchange. The one thing that's really cool about NFTs, because people don't understand it, is it provenance in a digital age. So if you're a digital creator and you create something, it's like having a negative. And if you think about it, if you collect NFTs, there's like some benefits to it. One is, like, if you're a traditional art collector, you have to store the art, right? There's cost of conservatorship. You have to transport it. Art is expensive. And you also have to pull them out of storage. So it's not accessible necessarily if you have an art collection. But NFTs, you collect them, you have them on your phone, you have them on your devices. They're building new screens for different ways. As this technology unfolds, they're going to have like picture frames that are holographic that will project these things as time goes on. And there's a sort of a metadata that's baked into the NFT. So for instance, if I buy an image or an NFT on the blockchain, what it will do is it will tell me if I buy it and then I sell it to somebody else, that all that information will be communicated and it travels with that NFT as that thing moves.
And the artist gets royalties, right?
Which is very...
You get your... Yeah, I love
it. Correct. And it's going to be actually going to have huge implications, I believe, in your world, in the music world, because all those ASCAP rights, all the different rights that and permissions and everything, if it's flat percentages on a crypto exchange, I sell it to somebody else, the commission's just tracked instantly. It goes into your account as the guy who wrote it or the person who performed it, and everybody gets their piece of the pie organically, as opposed to hiring lawyers to chase down South African rights that no one got paid for because somebody screwed somebody over, just was lazy and forgot to record it or report it. I think blockchain technology is going to really transform the way the whole fabric of our world works. This is the way the world is moving. We're going into a new age, and digital analog is like a beautiful thing. And I know I'm never say it's ever going to completely go away, because collectors physical. Like to have physical property, and it's so much more special.
But at the
and
same time, I mean, look
mind.
At what these kids are doing with their avatars and dressing up their characters. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. It's things are changing. As much as we love our physical, we love our digital too.
Well, consumers are being groomed to purchase in this way. Like, if you're playing video games, you're like, oh, I got to level up. Right. I need that new shield and that sword. That's going to cost me money. So people are being taught to buy art in this way. So the NFT isn't like a big jump for the younger generation, whereas older ones of us who think of like provenance is like, well, I need to have a negative and I need to have that doesn't, you know, that's
there
old
is a
analog
bit of that, right?
technology.
Patrick, my wife is actually getting for her father, for Donovan, they're going to do this Season of the Witch that he's hand drawn, and they're putting it out there with one of his live recordings. But apparently, like, whoever buys that package owns that version. So, I mean, are people owning your visuals at the end of the day? And obviously, there's a co-ownership, but how is that working out with the copyright?
So Dan and I will retain the copyright on the work. And that was one thing that will never be transferred in any of these NFTs. Like, if you purchase something, you don't own the copyright. You own the right to transfer it. Like, if you want to sell it to somebody else, it goes up in value. You want to sell your art, go for it. There's many different ways that the pie can be distributed. You could do a one-of-one NFT. So it's even more rare, more valuable. You could do something that is a limited edition of 100 or 200 or 1,000.
You know, Pat, I was just going to say that even if you're out of the NFT space, then you create a huge print of something that you photographed, and someone buys that print, a limited edition, say of 3, or it's a painting from a famous painter. That painter or that painter's estate retain the copyright, not the person who's bought it. Right.
So how are they doing? I mean, how are you seeing these NFTs selling for millions of dollars? What are they buying?
They're buying what's cool. They're buying what is contemporary and cool. And, you know, look, the older generation is having a little harder time to wrapping its head around this. You know, it's a little bit funky to look at it and just go, well, hey, why would I? But, you know, people aren't collecting images of Frank Sinatra. They're collecting images of Kobe Bryant.
But you could also create that package where one person has something and that is collectible at that point. That is something that they would be able to sell on in the future and probably even make money on it.
Yeah, well, the stuff does go up in value and people are making money on it. Some of it's publicity and hype, like Beeple sold something at Christie's for $70 million as a digital piece of art. But afterwards, it apparently got devalued down to 9 or 10 because it was just a PR stunt. So you got that. And that's my understanding. I don't want to speak. I mean, that guy's an incredible artist. Power to him for that. But we're in a weird time in terms of the future of technology and the fabric of our society and the way blockchain technology is going to transform our whole world. Our currency is going to go digital. This is happening. This isn't something that is theoretical at this point. It's how the internet transforms society. We're just at the beginning of this with the blockchain technology. It's going to evolve in ways that people aren't even expecting.
Well, I have a question. Daniel and Patrick, it's incredible what you guys are doing. And it's being said now that this is the next phase for the film, media, and entertainment industry. I have a friend that's doing a crypto comic. And so the comics are being released over NFTs over time. And blockchain technology is incredible because it means that you're protected and it's something that you can give straight to the consumer. So oftentimes there's no middlemen. But what you guys are doing, you're telling a story, a neo-noir story through these photographs. That's tremendous. But I have a question. What do you see as the next phase of this NFT space and the evolution of the industry within that?
Well, I hate to be a bearer of bad news, but I feel like there's going to be we've printed up so much money in the past year that we're on a bubble and it's going to pop like it popped back in 2008. And there's going to be a great sort of readjustment in terms of the economy. That's what I forecast. And just looking around there, I don't see how it could be any other way. To think it is just to kind of live on in some sort of, you know,
investing gold, I guess.
I mean, well, you got to carry that stuff around. It's like weighs a lot, and you got to have wheelbarrows and guns to protect it, I suppose.
And that, and this is the upside of the blockchain. Yeah, it's really, it's...
Yeah, it's and there's ways to obviously bury money in crypto that people can't track. So there's that aspect as well. I don't know. I think with NFTs, I think it's going to be around to stay. I believe there's going to be, as Dan was saying, when you get a 30 share and back in the day, and now it's like a 3 share is like a huge thing. Everything's becoming more fragmented. And so there's going to be all these different isolated collector pools that are into different things, and they already are. So I think we're going to see more of that, and there's going to be more of a specific oeuvre for every appetite and taste. And as consumers, we're going to have to decide where we want to invest our time and energy. And I think we're in a process of democratization, I believe, where at the top, there's always going to be the 1% that are going to collect, you know, legacy artwork, physical artwork. But the consumer level, there's a bunch of money sliding down to this NFT thing. It's more like punk rock. It's more like giving the finger to the establishment and saying, how do you, you 1% of people who have no connection with me, who you went to school to become some curator that's gallery approved, like, screw you. Who are you to tell me that you can't just be a consumer economy and not produce? And not everyone's NFTs are worth anything at all. Stuff people are throwing up there. I imagine the same thing with music. I mean, God, the music industry has totally transformed in the past 20 years. And everybody's making it. So how do you even penetrate and get to the top?
Well, that's the thing, is now doors are open, but how do you get notice coming through that door?
It's hugely difficult. It's a singles market now.
Well, back to the days of Elvis.
It's completely changed. There'll be no more bands like Coldplay, The Stones. That's it. It's over now.
Oh, thank you, TikTok. Very exciting. It's a new sector that music supervisors can focus on now. Thank you, Patrick and Daniel, bringing this very exciting topic to us. Something we're going to have to explore more of. But before, look, this interview has just been so epic and amazing, and I'm not going to let you go yet. Well, I want to end on some very exciting, positive notes about what you're doing now and into the future. We had talked briefly yesterday about a documentary that you're involved with and 2 feature films that you're developing. Would you be comfortable sharing any of those exciting topics with us?
Sure, I'll give you like a thumbnail on it. And I know Dan's developing a whole bunch of stuff, but I got a short doc. It's my friend. They're amazing. They live in Vegas. They're boudoir photographers. They're in their 70s.
Great.
And people fly in from all over the world to be photographed by them. He's Jamaican, dreadlocks, and she's Canadian, and they have a very unconventional relationship, and they take care of her dad, who's 101, is right there, and he's totally with it. They live in a penthouse off the strip in George Carlin's old apartment. Every day is some insane thing of different photo shoots. They're involved with people's wives. It's like Tiger King. I'm just looking at them like, this is just the weirdest, craziest thing you possibly imagine. I've been friends with them like 20 years. They've kind of been second parents to me in a way. Like, so yeah, I've been back and forth to Vegas a bit this year and shooting that. I got another shoot date on that, and then we'll be done with that. But that's just a little project. I'm not trying to go make a TV show or anything out of it. It's just cool. And then there's a big science fiction project that I've been developing for 5 years. What I realized very early on is that no one's going to give me the kind of money that I would want to have to go make this thing properly. So
never say never.
So I have to do the intermediate thing, the thing that's going to get people to go, oh yeah, you can tell a story. And that's the same way, by the way, as a photographer. Initially, when I was going around and trying to get work for studios, people were like, you have a nice portfolio, you have good pictures, but there's nobody famous in here, leave us alone.
It's the old and story. So, you know, you can't work without credits. You can't get credits without working. It's the chicken and egg.
Totally. So what you do is you do your own personal project and you show that to people. And that was my book, Face of the Sunset Boulevard. And that's actually, Dan and I became friends because that was the time period I was doing that project. Basically, they didn't even have to read the book. They could just say, oh yeah, you know what? Patrick came in here. I'm at Showtime Networks and he did a book. Oh, he did a book? Yeah, he's published. He's a published author. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So he's legit. Oh, okay. Now he's got some fame. Okay, he can do our job. No problem. Really? And I think it's the same way in the movie business. You got to have something that you can show. Otherwise, you're just talking about it like everybody else who's sitting outside the gates at the bars and that late night. It doesn't add up. And it's really hard. It's really difficult to get stuff done. Dan can speak to all that too, because he knows that world.
Hey, everybody,
intimately. I mean,
everybody
having operated at the very highest level. Yeah, everybody can talk about that. I mean, it's crazy. You got a bunch of, it's cool to be on a stage with such a diverse group of industry professionals who come at this from their individual perspectives. And I think you can all look at it and go, it's kind of
weird.
But
that is one thing,
there. That's
it a bridge is. We all share. Dan talking about being thrown into Miami Vice out of the editing bay. How do you get that first credit in that new field? You know, how did you go from music supervising to directing? That's crazy. So tell us, so for your filmmaking, what is your stepping stone process so you can get there?
You know what? I got a project that I'm writing right now that's going to cost $100,000. And that's something that nobody can tell me no on. If you take other people's money, then you have to listen to what they have to say. And that's all fair and well, but that might take a year or two. And then you're just running around town trying to get people drum up interest, read my thing, as opposed to just make your thing and then put it out there and go, hey, look, I got this. And people either like it or they don't.
Thank you, Patrick, and good luck with that new project. It sounds amazing. I hope you'll come back and tell us more, keep us updated. And of course, if you need a music supervisor, I know one or two. And Dan, thank you for joining us. Incredible to have you both on this interview. What a fun night. I hope to have you both back and wish you both the best of success with all you do. Hey, guys.
Hey, Jace.
Hey, Jason. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Just buried in paperwork.
Oh, for the sync report.
Not this time. Move me no mountain.
That indie film you're music supervising?
Yeah.
Sounds like a great project. What's the problem?
It's a brilliant film and we're building a great soundtrack, but you can't imagine how much paperwork I deal with for these films.
Have you heard of Sync Lodge?
First, you got to draft up the sync request forms.
I've heard of Sync Lodge.
Then drafting and issuing contracts.
Yep, Sync Lodge is great, Paula. It does everything a music supervisor needs.
Then deliver the cue sheet. It never ends.
Doesn't Sync Lodge do all of that automatically?
Sweat Lodge? What are you guys banging on about? I got real issues I'm sharing with you guys.
Yeah, lots of issues.
We're trying to tell you, Jason, Sync Lodge is a new platform for music supervisors. It helps you to source the music, sync songs against scenes, draft up sync requests, and even creates the cue sheets once you've locked in the music to the film.
Whoa, Sync Lodge does all that?
It's true, Jason. I just started using it for the sync report, and it's not only saving time, but it's so easy to use, I'm actually enjoying the work.
You guys are the best. Sync Lodge sounds amazing and exactly what I need for music supervising. Why am I always the last one to hear about these things?
I've been telling you about Sync Lodge for weeks.
Don't feel bad, Edge, for not telling me sooner. I know you're busy. You're a good guy.
Paula, is my mic on? Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Edge.
Guys, what's the name of that program again?
Sync Lodge.
That is something to scream about. Yes, you too can be cool like Edge and use cutting edge technology to help you with your film and TV productions. No matter if you're a music supervisor, director, producer, editor, save time and increase proficiency with Sync Lodge.
I need to find a new gig.
Sync opportunities, sync opportunities.
Why don't we go ahead? We have Hayden tonight. Hayden Andrews tapping in from Australia. Debbie discovered this songwriter in a clubhouse room where he's actually, you know, he's like the man. He plays live in these rooms. But now we've kidnapped him for a bit of storytelling and to listen to some of his music. I think, Don, are we going to play Mountain? Are we playing? Stuff?
Yes. Should we go ahead and start with that? Hayden. More than I have, and I'm interested to know his story. I definitely want to know.
And actually, you know, everybody get some tissues because there's a heavy story I'm going to make him share tonight. It's beautiful. Yeah, so why don't we do that? Why don't we play Mountain, which is actually the first song that was synced to Move Me No Mountain, four-time Emmy Award-winning director Debbie Richards, who has written, directed, edited one of the most sensational indie films that I've seen in a long time. Don, should we get into that?
Let's do that. Let's play the song Mountain from Hayden.
Thank you.
Hayden, welcome to the Sync Report, my friend. Yeah, absolutely love that song. The soundtrack is going to be so epic. Thank you for contributing.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. It's awesome.
Good morning.
Thank you
good
so
morning.
Much for having me. Yeah,
no, have your coffee, have your Red Bull, do whatever it is that you do to get your groove on. Like I said, I was introduced to Hayden by Debbie Richards last month, maybe a little bit longer ago, and had the pleasure of speaking with him. Hayden, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? Tell us about the room where you connected with Debbie. Give us a little bit of insight on Mountain.
Yeah, so I'm Hayden. I go under the name of Hayden Goseek as my solo sort of music stuff. For about 10 years, I've been playing in a band called Cheap Fakes. We tour the world and tour nationally in Australia and in New Zealand as well a lot. And then all the madness kind of happened with COVID and all that sort of stuff. And so people kept asking me to do sort of solo shows. And I just really wasn't that interested because I just always thought that playing solo was, you know, pretty boring. But I did a couple of gigs and I was like, wow, this is actually quite cool. And you can make it exciting with loop pedals and all that sort of stuff. And then I received a grant for a pretty decent amount of money to make an album from the council because they were just sort of trying to give artists opportunities. I recorded a solo album and that's all sort of ready to come out pretty soon, sort of over the next 5 months or so. Yeah, basically I met Debbie in the entertainment network room and I was just sort of down in my workshop with my guitar next to me and they asked me to sing a song and I just didn't really know what song to sing. So I just played one of my songs called Mountain and Debbie said to me, it's really bizarre because I've got a movie coming out called Move Me No Mountain. She's like, can we chat in the back channels? And so he did, and yeah, I'm absolutely stoked, you know, that she heard that song in that moment. So, you know, things can happen on this Clubhouse app and it's just such a beautiful community.
Yeah, what can happen here is incredible. You have no idea who you're gonna bump rooms, you know, and that is, I just love totally. That I love that these connections are being made, and now that you know has been brought into our community.
Hayden, can I say one thing about your sync? I have seen this already in the film, and I want to say, Hayden, it's a brilliant song. So many times in the sync world, we say, get right into the vocal, and, you know, we have these, would you call them rules, maybe? But I have to say that your track fits amazingly. She starts it at the top for the scene, and it just plays out wonderfully, and then your voice comes in. And so I want to say, you know, we have these rules, but you got to be able to bend those sometimes. And then the title was Mountain. And so she just clued in with you. Hayden, I love the song and how it fits in the movie. It's just brilliant.
Oh, God, I couldn't have said that any better. Yep. No, it is perfect. But look, Hayden, I want to, you know, I can't get your entire story, which, you know, I was so fascinated talking to you on so many levels, but recently you received a present, and it was right when I'd called you. Something really powerful happened in your life. So I don't know, Hayden, do you feel comfortable talking about your friend and what just happened?
Yeah, for sure. Make a long story a short story. Basically, one of our good friends, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer probably about 6 months ago. He decided he would take 43 of his best friends on this big weekend away up to Port Douglas. And so we all jumped on a plane from all over Australia and we flew to this basically paradise on earth, you know, tropical, like palm trees. And we had like just 3 nights of just partying and just having fun. And he, I made it, his name is Batchy. And he called that Batchy's Wake because he didn't want to have a funeral or anything like that. A couple of weeks after that, he asked me to write a song about the weekend. And, you know, I was happy to oblige. And so I wrote this song. It's called Never Forget. And we recorded it. We took it to the studio and recorded it. Me and my best mate, probably about 5 weeks ago now, he called me up and he told me that he wanted to buy one of his best friends that he went to school with. He said, I want to buy him a really nice guitar, you know, before I die. And so I put him in contact with this local guitar maker called Aaron Fennick, who in Australia, who makes the most beautiful handcrafted guitars. Batchy rang up and said, look, I've literally got about 3 weeks until I die. I need this guitar. They dropped everything and they made this beautifully handcrafted guitar. And then they rang me up to come and pick it up for Batchy's mate. And I walked into the workshop and they were filming me as I walked in. And he pretty much just dropped the bomb. He said, look, mate, it's not for Batchy's mate. I mean, you know, it is for Batchy's mate. But they said, this guitar's for you. And they handed me this guitar and I just yeah, literally broke down crying. And I was like, oh my God, like it's the most beautiful guitar I've ever seen. And just the most beautiful sentiment that anyone has ever given to me. You know, this gift is just unbelievable. That guitar, I've named it Betchy. And
honestly, Hayden, it bonded you to my heart and my soul immediately. I mean, just, you know, your love for this friend, you know, your compassion, your willingness to do what you could, you know, to use your talents to help this man achieve some of these final goals. And then for him to surprise you like that, I mean, so do you have the good guitar now?
I can get it.
I don't know. Should we try to make Hayden do something live or should we stick to the script, Don?
Oh, my. Yeah, I know we have Never Forget in the list, but Hayden, what do
Hayden,
you want to do?
What do you prefer? Should we play the track or would you prefer to do something live for us?
Maybe play the track, and if I could play just a little bit after it, it would be
perfect.
Okay.
All right, Don, let's play the track while he's going to get his guitar.
On a plane this morning, destination unknown. Anticipation's high, I don't know where we're going. Along for the ride are strangers, soon to be my friends. It's gonna be a weekend we'll never forget. Touchdown, then on a bus, head to where we'll stay. Ended up in paradise, I just can't wait to play. I take a deep breath and look around and grab myself a drink. It's gonna be a weekend we'll never forget. Live each day to the most. Dance like no one is watching. Just hold your love one.
Did I tell you this guy's fucking awesome? Oh my God. I mean, forget everything that song means and why Hayden wrote it, but I could hear that as a very syncable track. All right, Hayden, before you talk about it, let's get some of the panel to weigh into. Let's start with our DJ, our music supervisor, one of my best friends, Milfredo Seven. Was that beautiful or was that beautiful?
Right. I didn't really like it.
I hated that one.
I absolutely loved it.
Oh, yay!
Yeah, Hayden, man, that is just I liked the tune. I really liked it. And then when the story is just like, oh, man, I love that song. Do you know what? I have, as shallow as I sound usually, I do actually have one heartstring, and that tugged all on it, man. That was, do you know what I mean? It's just one of those songs that makes you question, like, the path you've taken in life. And, you know, I've got a group of friends, and I can just imagine that party. I really can. It is just like, oh, what a thing to have done. It's amazing. And from a music point of view, which is why we're here, I mean, it drifted between Hawaii and Trench Town, and which was such a nice journey, you know. It was just like, it sat between like two oceans. When I say I wasn't sure which one it sat in, but it sat in both perfectly. And what's not to like?
Honestly, Jack Johnson.
Yeah. Oh,
Jack
mate, Johnson, yes.
Is crying right now.
Yeah, it is.
Track.
It's a surfer's barbecue tune, isn't it? It's just like all the right sounds in all the right places. Genius. What a lovely song, mate. Yeah, you've tugged on my single heartstring, Hayden, so well done.
And honestly, that is a compliment and a half, Hayden.
The funny thing about it as well is the chorus that says, live each day to the most, dance like no one's watching, hold your loved ones close, and never be afraid to speak your mind. He gave us all a stubby cooler, or if you guys call it a koozie.
Yeah, I know stubby. Yeah, stubby. Yeah. Cooler.
No, I don't know. What is it?
For your drink. Put your drink in. Put your beer in. Yeah, a stubby.
Yeah, so he gave us it. All a stubby cooler, and those were the words that were written on it. And so I sort of had a melody, and then I was like, oh, I'll use that for the chorus, and it just worked perfectly.
Yeah, that was beautiful. Hayden, I know it's like 6 a.m. for you, so if you don't want to do a live performance, I totally get it, but do it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah!
I got the beast, yeah.
So this is the guitar, right? Did you explain that this is handcrafted by this guy in Australia? Did we hear that?
Yeah, it's a beautiful, it's made from Australian blackwood, and it's got like just like all little inlays in it, and it's such a beautiful guitar. I opened the case and just I just smell it. It smells amazing, and it's such a nice guitar.
I love that guitar smell. Ugh. All right, so what are you going to do, the acoustic version of that? What are you going to play for us?
I was going to play another one just to keep it.
Mix it up a little? All
exciting.
Right.
Yeah. This one's called Round and Round. Hopefully we'll see if my voice works at 6:30 in the morning.
So long, so long now, I've gotta go. A heavy heart and a broken smile will never be the same. This life, life's just a glorious game. But I was happy to be wasting my time. I'm telling you, it doesn't matter where you are. I could be your guiding star, but round and round we go. Where it ends, we'll never will creep in slow. Warm as the sun, but you'll never know. Maybe, maybe I should sell my guns. I feel I'm lost and the tide is gone. So fill yourself with alcohol. There is nothing set in stone, but round and round we go. Where it ends, we'll never know. Just fill yourself with alcohol. There is nothing set in stone, but round and round we go. Where it ends, we'll never know. Where it ends, we'll never know. Where it ends, we'll never know.
That guitar is just about as beautiful as you are of a human.
Man, thank you.
I'm so glad to know you. I'm so glad to have you part of this room. I'm so proud that you're part of Move Me No Mountain. Congratulations on that sync. Thank you for supporting Debbie with your music and your artistry. Thank you for joining us today. Kev, please take the mic. I think I got to go cry for a minute.
Yeah, I almost cried into my response. I'm so happy that that the decision was made for you to do a little live piece of what you do. That was a gift. And I didn't comment on the other song because it kind of just rolled all the way through. And I'm glad that I can comment on both at the same time. So much heart and soul in both of them. Anyone that has lost someone.
Did we lose someone?
Yeah. Sorry. Because I did lose some people. And that was beautiful.
God, honestly, I don't know if we can go on with the show, Hayden. You've totally fucked us up, man.
It absolutely was. I said goodbye to a friend yesterday, too, Hayden. 87 years old, lived a full life, but you know, it's never supposed to happen. Your music, I have said this before in this room, this kind of music actually gives hope and makes you feel better even when the emotions are coming out. Thank you so much.
It's funny you say that, Don. I just saw this quote from Keanu Reeves, of all people. He was on a late night talk show, and the question was, what do you think happens when you die? And his response is, well, people that loved you will be sad. And I just thought that was just what an incredible response and very apropos for the energy in the room right now.
Right, listen, Hayden, you just better give us something happy next, mate, because otherwise you're banned. I'm not having this kind of emotion on a show. Just, right, yeah. So whatever's next, make it happy.
Yeah, sorry, guys. It wasn't necessarily, you know, super sad, but it was, as Mofredo said, if you have a heartstring, your music definitely tugs on it. So, yeah, really brilliant stuff there, Hayden.
I was just going to say, Hayden, I think you touched a nerve on most of our team, which means your music is highly syncable, I suspect, because there's lots of scenes in films that require music that touches that kind of emotion.
And we're like, this is like a room full of hard guys here. We're real gangster badasses, and you just brought us all to our knees. Although Mofredo will laugh at as I'm saying that, because all I do is cry and compliment men on how good they look. So, Hayden, Vinks, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah, man, I'm just really proud that you guys are open-hearted and open-minded to allow the beauty of the songwriter to really come in there, not just for the moments that fit neatly into a scene, but the fact that you recognize that you can't always plan magic, and when you hear it and it's beautiful, you accept it and you find a place for it, the destination in the end. But I appreciate that you guys are open to the beautiful craft of songwriting and the messages that are giving.
Thank you, Vinks. Thank you, Mofredo and Kevin. And, you know, even, you know, if you could see the back channel with my team, Hayden, you really have. You've moved us all. We have to do it again. I know you're full up to your eyeballs with great music. So we will have you back on the stage, Hayden.
Thank you so much. I also write happy songs too.
So yeah, kudos, Hayden. Yeah, I'm sad to move on, but we're going to move on. We're going to bring up the energy. Let's start listening to these submissions then, Don.
Let's do it. So I have to say, I haven't gotten much in the Asian hip hop brief. So this one came in, and this is Lohi or Lohi. I'm not sure how, but he's on the stage now, and I would love to play this because I heard a little bit of it, and I'm excited about it. Jason, I want to know what you think. It's called Bag That Bow.
Bag that bow, bag that bow, bag that bow, bag that bow. 我手一手抱一包拍一包，写几个字随便搞一搞，我飞到太阳让我飘一飘，抱一抱，抱一抱，抱一抱，抱一抱，我手一手抱一包拍一包，写几个字随便搞一搞，我飞到太阳让我飘一飘，抱一。
我有个宝宝来给我给拥抱，我没有口靠靠，哎，我爱我的姥姥，你找到了生活膨胀里的痛脑，哎，慢点速度，提起平稳，带我超过雾路，也是种凯，也车葫芦，哥们跟我一直没有孤独，除了世上打了吃啊，没我火气，当我准备无法逃亡，所以我得迷上我的腰杆，一半老百姓，一半鲁伊韦德，一半里面，一半乔丹，
带带宝，带带宝。
I dig it. That piano is so cool. I dug the raps. That was something very, I don't know, is that Dre Snoop Doggy piano thing going on? I dig it. I dig it. I dig it. All right, let's get this guy to introduce himself.
Yes, I want to meet him.
Hi, low.
Hey,
is that what I'm saying it right?
Yeah, Lohi. That's right.
Lohi. What's happening, man? Who are you? Where are you tapping in from? Tell us about that track.
Good, man. No, thank you guys for the space. That's been amazing music so far. Tapping in from LA. I'm a rapper. I'm like on the second verse and the hook of this song. That's a group I'm part of called Night Market. So we do like Chinese American, like trap and hip hop. So that's where that music's coming from. My own personal music is more like alt R&B, lo-fi. But for my own stuff, I also mix English and Mandarin in my stuff. But yeah, for Night Market, I'm the resident Mandarin rapper.
Well, I think it's wicked cool. Let's hear what the panel have to say about that. Mofredo, do you want to chime in?
Yeah, the resident Mandarin rapper. That's a sentence I didn't think I'd hear when we switched on today. But yeah, man, do you know what? I love it. It's dirty. It reminds me of, I don't know, some of like the French and like the early Marseille hip hop from like the 2000s and like a cross between like some of the UK grime as well. I know you're saying it's trap and stuff, but I can imagine like, you know, something coming out of Newham like that. Do you remember like, oh, maybe not, but Kenny Arcana and Kalash? It was just like real attitude, less is more, more edgy. And you could just feel the attitude in it. That piano is filth. It really is. It's just like,
I love that piano.
Yeah, and the miners in it, it just gives it a real sinister feel. What is it about? I've got to know, because it's got a hook. I don't even know what the hook is.
Well, that's exactly it.
But how good is it?
Because
I can feel the hook, but I don't even know what it is. So that's genius. Yeah. What is it, man?
It's funny because, you know, the term like, let's get this bread.
Yeah.
You know, people were talking about like, let's get this bread, let's get this money. But I was like working with our producer, and there was this like term circling around like the Asian online like meme space.
Yeah.
Called, like the Chinese equivalent of let's get this bread is like, let's bag that bao. Bao is like a Chinese bun. So yeah, we're just like, yeah, that's our version of Let's get this money.
Even better. Yeah. It's good. It sounds like it too. Dirty money. Love it, man. Oh, I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
That's right. Thank you, man.
Was that hook? It sounded like body ba. I mean, that was hot. It was hot. Body.
Thanks, Kevin.
Ba. Body. Ba. I loved it, man. That track was, it was brilliant. Not too long ago, I saw a documentary on Chinese underground hip hop. And this is underground hip hop scene in China, actually. And so I don't know if you're cued in on that at all.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, they have a really hot scene going on there in China in the hip hop. And it reflects here in the States as well, and back and forth and back and forth. But man, that piano, of course, the track, hot, the verses, fire. Whoever was spitting on that. I mean, I know you were.
Yeah, that was the second half of it.
Yeah, that was a dragon, man. Y'all spit some fire on that. So, I mean, I don't know if it's going to get synced on that particular sync brief, but I want that fire.
Okay, let's want that in the bag here, and I'm definitely sending that to director Jason, don't you think?
Most definitely. I think Debbie would really, really dig that track.
I do. I think so, too.
Yeah, and just for Kevin, like a little bit of a history lesson, too. The producer behind this song, his name is Chops, and he was on a group called Mountain Brothers way back in like the 70s, 80s. And they were the first Asian hip hop group to ever be signed to a major label. So, you know, it's on some like Big Brother, Little Brother stuff, but we got connected to him. He produced it. So, and we like went on tour with some people from China that like started the underground, like freestyle rap scene out there. So, you know, it's a small community.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds like a story there. That sounds like a second documentary right there, man.
That was incredible. But it is the end of the night. Everybody on the team, thank you again from the bottom of my heart. Paula, Kev, Wilfredo, Miles, Edge, and Robert. Even the guys that aren't able to join us on the show. It's like that beautiful swan looks so elegant. But beneath that swan, there's crazy legs going just to keep that thing looking cool and sounding right. And we have that amazing team.
Thank you so much to our amazingly talented guests for joining us on today's show, and to you, our listeners, for spending your time listening to us and being with us. The Sync Report cast will be back in a week with your hosts, myself, Colin O'Donoghue, Rose Ganguza, and Jason P. Rothberg. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.